So I just want to speak a little bit for a few minutes just to contextualize the next stage, because you remember we're exploring the system of meditation, at least broadly and briefly. So I've brought the Nidana chain back just to remind you of what was said yesterday, that there's a movement from a primary experience, which is then conceptualized, and that conceptualization gets out of hand. There's a calling upon all sorts of memories, of reflections, of experiences, of cultural input patterns, and so forth. It spreads out and gets mixed up with underlying tendencies which go very, very deep. As deep, you might say, as humanity itself, and as shallow as you. And that then forms into a structure. It may not be a consistent structure, it may have contradictions within it, but a structure of interpretation, construction, through which our experience is then filtered. So all new experience is filtered through this construction which develops out of prapancha. And that's what I call secondary experience or secondary reality. It's more like a secondary reality than a secondary experience. It's a secondary reality imposed upon experience. And primary experience is back there. It's just the contact, the sparsha, the vedana, the immediate experience of pleasure, pain, or nothing in particular, and samya, the interpretation of that experience in simple terms, the identification of objects, the ordering of experience in a way that's very closely related to the actual contact and feeling. And we saw that the first thing we need to do is to keep bringing ourselves back to primary experience. And you could say that's what integration really is. You're learning to, or rather you're encouraging yourself more frequently to simply be in contact with what is going on right now. And not drifting off into patterns of interpretation, of bifurcations of experience, polyfications of experience, just coming back to what's actually going on right now and keeping track of that. So then we saw that vitakka is a key factor, self-conscious reflection. And of course, reflection isn't merely words going through your mind. It's a more integral activity at its best. And what vitakka tries to do is, first of all, redirect you to what's actually going on. So the sort of thing that we're doing in the exercises in the morning, looking at sensations, bringing yourself back to sensations, trying to let go of the construction of those sensations in terms of an image of yourself. Just experience what's there, experience the energy. I think that's why Qigong is so useful, because it encourages energy to flow, so you have a stronger experience of it. So that's mindfulness. That vitakka directs you back to what's going on. It encourages mindfulness. Vitakka also helps you to work out what to do, how to act in situations by applying sila, applying especially sila in the form of the precepts. So you're reflecting on your experience and giving yourself a check, a framework that helps you to act in a way that's skillful. Skillful action is always going to be much more directed, or much more directed from and to primary experience, rather than up in prapancha. Vitakka also helps you to direct yourself into deeper experience, especially through meditation, but through other forms of creative, artistic, aesthetic experience, which bring greater richness and meaning. Well, first of all, richness to experience, so that primary experience isn't just sort of bare fact. It's the immediate experience increasingly enriched with aesthetic significance. Of course, aesthetic doesn't necessarily mean pleasant, but that's another question. Just to make sure we don't think it means surrounding it with a rosy glow. Sometimes aesthetic experience is painful. For instance, when you realize that you've acted unskillfully, that experience is painful, but it invests the moment, as it were, with greater richness. When you experience the fact that, the suffering around you, that is not a pleasant experience, but it's an enriching experience. When you experience the fact that there's sort of a limitation to your experience, that you're not really fully seeing the richness of things, that can be a painful experience, but it's an enriching painful experience, if you see what I mean. So when we talk about aesthetic experience, I think it's quite important not to just see that as one-sided heaven. It's when you view the world with an enriched aesthetic eye, it includes light and shade. But the light is brighter and the shade is sharper, you might say. So yes, your vitakka directs you into a deeper and richer experience, especially, of course, characteristically through meditation. Through meditation, you're not escaping from your primary experience, you're deepening and enriching your primary experience. Even going into realms of experience that are present, but not sort of immediately open to you. In other words, the dhyana worlds, the worlds of the gods and so forth. Those are not escapes. They're not escapes up into prapancha. They're deepenings of and enrichings of present experience. And lastly, vitakka works in that way by sort of drawing your attention to the aesthetic dimensions of your experience and opening it up. You know, you characteristically get that with art, with literature. The art, or the literature perhaps particularly, the writer describes his experience, her experience, and that enables you to bring greater depth and meaning to what you're experiencing, and lights things up. And with the same with the artist, that you borrow the artist's eye, or rather the artist's eye opens your eye. The famous, very characteristic experience, you look at paintings and when you come away the world is different. I remember seeing the Vermeers in Amsterdam and coming out, and everything had a stillness and poise that I sort of learnt from Vermeer. It's not kind of fantasizing onto real experience. It's drawing out dimensions of a primary experience which are not immediately apparent to one with a plain factual eye. So vitakka directs one deeper into this. You can learn to see more clearly. You talk to somebody who's got an enriched eye, and your own eye enriches. You talk to somebody who's got a deeper poetic experience, and that draws out your own poetry. You talk to somebody who's got a feeling for the deep narrative rhythms of life, and that, you know, maybe even in dramatic form, and that draws that out in your own experience. So vitakka helps to bring that greater richness to experience. Vitakka also brings meaning through reflection, in a very much the same way as I've talked about it in terms of richness. You can see what I'm doing. I'm distinguishing between the shamatha dimension of spiritual life and the vipassana or prajna element in spiritual life. Samadhi, prajna, shamatha, vipassana. So shamatha I'm talking about, or samadhi I'm talking about in terms of a greater richness and depth, and prajna and vipassana in terms of greater meaning. So vitakka directs you to see, to notice, to discover greater meaning in your primary experience, and ultimately to discover the full meaning, which is in terms, as it were, negatively, of recognizing the impermanent, insubstantial nature of it, and it's the impossibility of it providing lasting happiness. And on the positive side, and an experience of a reality that goes beyond, it's implicit in, but goes beyond the our normal experience. I'll say much more about that when we come on to the stage of spiritual death and of rebirth. So thus far, this is the way that the cycle works, and the way the spiral works. The spiral works by bringing you back, first of all, to primary experience by the use of intelligence. Intelligence not necessarily merely conceptual or verbal, but an intelligent redirection to the basis of your experience. An intelligent choosing of ways to act that enhance your life and the lives of others. An intelligent exploration of your experience to bring out its deeper richness and depth. An intelligent interrogation of your experience to discover its deeper meaning, its full meaning. But so far we've talked about it mainly in terms of mindfulness, and then I brought in these other dimensions, but our exploration in the retreat has been mainly in terms of mindfulness. But the stage of integration is succeeded by the stage of positive emotion. You need to come back to primary experience. You can't develop positive emotion fully or integrally without that. Otherwise, what you're doing is you're developing positive emotion in the midst of to some degree unreal construction of experience, which is bound to be contradictory and negatory. You can work out the details for yourself, but your Maitri, for instance, your positive emotion is likely to become mixed up with selective choices. So you'll love my people, not others, and so on. So you need to come back to primary experience, but merely being back with primary experience is not enough. You need to have a positive intention within it, if you see what I mean. Of course, that's where Shila comes in. Shila is a way of guiding yourself to have positive intentions, a positive orientation. That is an orientation that is wishing the best for yourself and the best for others. An intention of maitri, of metta. So that your mindfulness is imbued with metta. That's the next sort of level that one needs to come to. You need the basis in your actual experience. Otherwise, your metta, it's very difficult to develop it, and it tends to become sentimentalized easily, or segmentalized, if you see what I mean. And I think one of the issues often with teaching metta is that people do not have enough immediate awareness of themselves, so that their metta is fantasy metta, secondary metta, which is not metta, or only partially metta, and which tends to be a little bit sort of rosy, a bit of a sort of fantasy metta. So you need to be grounded in your immediate experience, which will include unpleasant Vedana. That's part of the problem, isn't it, with an ungrounded metta, that it's very easy to be swept away by unpleasant experience, if you see what I mean. But a genuine metta takes into account unpleasant experience as much as pleasant experience. So yes, I hope that gives some idea of why metta comes next, why the stage of positive emotion comes next. I think there's some importance. It's important to re-examine the notion of emotion. It's a word we use very easily, and Bhante sort of described this stage as the stage of positive emotion. But emotion is a pretty fuzzy term. It's not a precise term. And all too often, people think of emotion in terms of the pleasant and unpleasant experience. You see what I mean? So they mix up emotion with Vedana, to put it in Buddhist terms. And I think probably the English word emotion is sort of covers a broad spectrum, which includes Vedana, but also includes karma or chetana, samskara. It includes intentionality. So emotion in English is not really quite a clear enough term. And I think one of the consequences of that is that when people are developing metta, we expect to have a pleasurable experience. So you think of metta in terms of pleasurable experience. Ultimately, if you're feeling metta, it will be pleasurable. But we'll go into why. But it's not about developing a pleasurable experience. It's about developing skillful intentions, helpful intentions. The Buddha in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta talks about metta, a mental kamma. So it's kamma, not vipaka. I think a lot of what goes wrong with metta, I'm sure this has been well stated these days, a lot of what goes wrong with metta is that people are expecting a vipaka rather than making an effort, developing intentions. In India, we have a big problem because the word bhavana has changed its meaning. It now means, in modern Hindi and Marathi and other North Indian languages, it means more like your Vedana. So people will ask you, "Apko bhavana kya hai? What is your feeling? How do you feel?" You know, somebody will say to you, "What's your feeling about this retreat, bhavana?" So when they hear metta bhavana, they get completely the wrong understanding. So we're trying to change the name of the practice. But actually, a similar problem comes here, because I think often it's talked about as an emotion, and or even feeling, a feeling of metta. I find myself doing that. But these are very imprecise terms and direct you to the pleasant and painful. Whereas actually the whole effort of metta is to develop intentions. So it's an effort to begin with, especially. You're trying to change the current of your mind. Well, you may have to. You may be extremely positive already, or extremely have positive intentions already, skillful intentions already. But you're trying to change the way in which your desires, your wishes emerge, so that you're trying to change your intentionality, so that it becomes more and more skillful, more and more helpful. I sometimes think that the word skillful itself is not as clear as it should be. It's a nice word if you analyse the meaning, but I think what it really means is helpful. Helpful to you and helpful to others, if you see what I mean. I think it's a better way of thinking of it. You're trying to develop helpful intentions. Helpful to you, helpful to others, helpful to whoever's affected. So instead of reacting as we do on the basis of Vedana, whooshing off into prapancha, we're trying to develop a realistic awareness of what's going on, and then helpful intentions in relation to it. Metta is about intentionality. It's not about Vedana. It's not about pleasant or unpleasant feelings. I think it's very important to think of it as retraining yourself to the extent that you need it. Or if you're already trained in that direction, well, strengthening and deepening spontaneous, helpful intentionality, stream of intentionality. It's an experience of what's really going on. It's not escaping from or running from the Vedanas and sparsha that you're having. It's really being aware of what's going on around you and developing in relation to that the most helpful wishes that you can, most helpful intentions that you can. And you need to work against sometimes patterns of reactivity, patterns of intentionality that are unhelpful. Unhelpful immediately, sometimes unhelpful in the longer run. It's a definite effort. Metta is a redirecting of the course of your mind to the extent that that's necessary, or to the extent that it's not necessary, a strengthening of the course of your intentions, so they become more helpful, more skillful. It's a karma. With metta, you're working directly on karma. You're working to immediately strengthen skillful motivations. Of course, that will have a vipaka. And this is the, as it were, pleasurable side of the practice. One would expect that as you develop more and more metta, the vipakas that are appropriate to that, those helpful intentions, will begin to fructify. You'll begin to have a pleasurable experience. When you're really directing positive intentions, sustainedly, there will be a payback in terms of a certain degree of happiness, of fulfillment, of even inspiration, upliftment, and so on. So I think very important to remind oneself that it's not about developing a pleasant feeling, but that you will develop pleasant feelings if you carry out the practice long enough and sustainedly enough. You may have a lot of past karma to work off, so you don't think about the payback. You just sort of have faith in the principle of karma, and eventually that karma will give you the vipakas that are appropriate. There's something very, very important to keep coming back to. I've been thinking about this quite a bit in my own experience and in my teaching life in India, especially. And I've begun to think that perhaps we need to stress this much more in the West. I don't know whether people generally have sufficient confidence in karma. The whole spiritual life is predicated upon karma. It's predicated upon the underlying mechanism of life. Of course, it's only one of the five mechanisms. We know that there are three physical niyamas, and there's one transcendent niyama. But the spiritual life itself is predicated upon upon karma. If there was no karma, your efforts in the shrine room would be unavailing. You would do the metta bhavana one day and get, strong, negative, painful feelings immediately. And another day you do it, or you go and hit somebody and get very, very positive feelings. I know that does happen. But it's a sort of overall current and trend. That's the unfortunate thing, isn't it? Sometimes you sit in the shrine, you do Maitri and Bhavana, and you feel awful. But that's because of the karma is an accumulation, not a one for one business. But I think one of the things we need to strengthen in ourselves is our faith in the mechanism of karma, to put it that way. That the mind works according to laws as powerful and as ambiguous as those that govern physical matter. Karma is as veridical as gravity is. It's part of the structure of things. The universe is structured so that skillful intentions, helpful intentions, lead to an increasing sense of fulfillment and happiness and joy. That's the way it's built. And so we're working with the fundamental currents of life. So when you're doing a practice like Maitri Bhavana, you need to have a certain faith in that underlying structure. And you do the practice in the strong belief, which hopefully is being reinforced increasingly by experience, that your efforts will be rewarded. I think this is one of the things that Bhante was stressing in these recent talks I've had with him, the radical nature of the Buddha's departure from the framework within which he was brought up. Gombrich is very good at exploring this in his Buddhist Beginnings. Anybody's interested in the scholarly background to it. But actually, it's a radical departure from the way most people think about life. And we need to, I think, strengthen our own conviction in karma. I think it's part of the sort of lack of faith that runs through the movement every now and again. We stop believing that skillful efforts further, and we think that techniques or different teachings or whatever are what it's all about. Or we think that we're reliant upon teachers more than we need to be. We're actually reliant upon the fundamental processes of life. And all the Dharma does is point us back to those fundamental processes and tell us that these are what we need to live in accordance with. Just as when we want to lift a brick and put it on a wall, we need to be aware of the law of karma. When we want to be happy, when we want to be fulfilled, when we want to benefit others, we need to work with the fundamental laws of karma. So when we're doing Maitri, when we're developing positive emotion, the stage of positive emotion, that is the stage of positive intention, we are doing it in the conviction that that it will be beneficial. Beneficial to us, beneficial to others. That our, the increasing development of positive intentions will, be a contribution ultimately to the world. It'll enable us to act in a world that, in a way that really does make things better. And we believe that through developing these positive intentions, we will experience increasing sense of fulfillment, of satisfaction, even if we're suffering, even if life is difficult in a material sense. Will have a sense of fulfillment, of satisfaction, and a sense of innocence. This wonderful Pali word, avipatisara, or in Sanskrit, avipratishara, which means a freedom from remorse, not having anything to reproach yourself with, being able to sit down and feel innocent, that there's nothing you've done that's harmed anybody, nothing you've done that's been undignified in your own values, as it were, and a really strong sense of, kind of positive self-satisfaction, confidence, therefore. So when you're developing this stage of positive emotion, this is the result, this freedom from remorse, the joy, pramudita, that comes from a sense of freedom from remorse. He's very well named, isn't he? So that you feel sort of innocent and the very happy sense of ease that comes with that. So this stage of positive emotion ensues from the stage of integration by on the basis of your awareness of what really is, developing these positive intentions. Well, I think there are interesting questions even about mindfulness outside that context. I certainly think that it's not invaluable, if I might put a double negative in it, but it's limited. And you're sort of implying the karmic context without stating it, but really for people to take the full benefit, they need to move into a more ethical, in the Buddhist sense of ethical, that is moving with the underlying mechanism of life. So I think that probably if one's doing that and one wants to do it in a way that is really helpful to people, you'll be increasingly sort of feeding in a karmic viewpoint. What's really interesting is what about the Dhamma Nyama, but we'll come on to that later. If you don't have that belief in karma, these techniques can only be of limited benefit. And probably what you'll be doing if you're teaching the Metta Bhavana, you'll be sort of stressing, don't worry about the feeling, just make the intention and that will eventually sort of benefit you. So you'll be sort of implying karma. And probably most people have a vague sort of acceptance of it. I was just reading a sutta in Samyutta Nikaya where the Buddha is distinguishing the different niyamas in effect. He's sort of saying, no, I do not teach that all pleasant and painful feeling comes from karma. There is pleasant and painful feeling that comes from wind in the bowels. Well, we all know about that, and so on. And yes, it's only one of them. And he says that this is, that all people accept this is true. In other words, it's self-evident to some extent, probably not to a sufficient degree, but to some extent. So I think if one's using these, sort of dumber light techniques, one needs to be sort of drawing more and more to people's attention the full force and implication, if you dare, if you can do that without violating the context, if you see what I mean.
Which sutta was that?
It's a very important sutta in Samyutta Nikaya called the Molya Sivaka Sutta. Very, very useful. It doesn't actually use the niyamas, but it implies the niyamas. It talks about 8 different conditioning factors, like, bile, phlegm, wind, a combination of the three, carelessness, I presume that means an accident, assault, and karma. There might be one other, can't remember. So it's not very systematic, but the Buddha is making it absolutely clear that he's not saying that everything that happens to you is a result of karma. Yeah, I think these techniques that are drawn from Buddhism are interesting, and I'm not myself completely made up my mind about them. Maybe I never will. And I think it very much depends what you're trying to do with them, whether your aim is narrowly therapeutic, which is, when I say narrowly, therapy is a damn good thing if it cures people. But if your aim is to sort of bring into play the larger perspective of the Dharma, then and you really believe that's ultimately what people need, then how you make the transition is going to be an interesting question for you. Karma works, whether people believe in it or not. So in a way, you could say that you're getting people to work with karma even though they don't know it. But I think we need to be getting the karmic viewpoint out into the discourse. And there's a lot of research. I've been investigating a little bit these the new outposts, outgrowings, interesting enough, of economics, hedonics it's sometimes called. Where people are asking, is gross national product and domestic development, growth of the economy, is that the best way of measuring whether we've got a successful society? And they're saying, well, no, but what is the best way to do that? Well, surely the best thing is to try to work out whether people are getting happier. And so serious economists, mainstream economists, starting with a Nobel Prize winner, Kahneman, have been investigating this, the science of happiness. Some very, very interesting work, most of which is what I've read of it, little I've read of it, really directly verifies assertions the Buddha made 2,500 years ago and that are really expressions of karma. I recommend the book called Happiness by Richard Layard, otherwise known as Lord Layard, who is an advisor to the Labour government, which we won't hold against him. They probably aren't following his advice.